This is Where We Live.
Change is coming to Connecticut. Dan Malloy has had his chance, and change is coming.
We fought hard. We came close. But at the end of the day, Tom Foley ran a better race. Tom Foley is our candidate for governor. And what I told Tom Foley is that 100% of my efforts from tomorrow morning until November 4th will be getting Tom Foley and other Republicans elected in November. That is our goal.
Those are two voices from last night. First, Tom Foley accepting the nomination of the Republican Party to be their candidate for governor once again, followed by the man he beat, State Senator John McKinney. Today in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, we will look at the results from a day that did not exactly spark the enthusiasm of voters. From that governor's race to a lieutenant governor's contest that is still too close to call to a few interesting races at the city level, we're going to talk to our panelists. Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. He's always here, and he's back with us again this Wednesday. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
And Mark Pasniokas is here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Did you get some sleep, Paz?
Let's not talk about that.
And Kalila Brown-Dean, she's associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. She's been working on research all summer long, and we're really glad to have her back in the chair. Kalila, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up later on in the program, Secretary of the State Denise Merrill will be stopping by to talk about these really inspiring turnout numbers that we had yesterday. I'm making some jokes about this, but Colin, before we get to the race for governor, I had mentioned to Diane Orson on Morning Edition just a little bit ago that if the downpours of rain, the buckets of rain that we were having today actually happened yesterday, I don't know if anybody would have come to the polls. We're looking at around 20% turnout for the Republican primary. Even by August standards, that's not very good.
No, 4 years ago it was about 29%, so this is a serious fall. And it's hard to explain why that is. I mean, obviously it's not entirely attributable to an August primary. As I think Chris Keating pointed out last week, the September numbers, you know, aren't typically all that different. There's something else going on here. And it seems as though, at least on the Republican side, John McKinney and Tom Foley never really persuaded the Republican electorate that there was a real urgent choice that had to be made. That somehow or other, this seemed like something that people could sit out, that it wasn't made meaningful. I mean, the other theory is that people just kind of didn't know there was a primary for some reason, although I don't quite understand that either. There were, you know, just as many ads and plenty of coverage, and I wouldn't believe that, except that I heard it from so many people.
Paz, your thoughts on this? Because we're going to be talking with Denise Merrill, the Secretary of State, about this issue a little bit later. But I'd like to get your takes on the turnout and whether or not, you know, Colin's theory or the theory he's been hearing. You know, people just didn't know this was happening.
Well, I will partly take issue with my esteemed colleague. No, I think it is explicable to a degree. This was really the only race of note. So therefore, there was no synergy. You know, Connecticut's been lucky since they went to August primaries. In 2006, you know, the circus came to town. It was a national race. So that explained the turnout for Lieberman and Lamont. In 2010, you had all kinds of primaries. You had Linda McMahon dropping tons of money early. It had the buzz. It had the vibe of November. So I think Colin's right in that the tone of this campaign was much flatter until Foley and McKinney qualified for public financing, which didn't occur until last month. It really was an inside game. And this is something that probably will renew a necessary debate or examination about Connecticut's convention system. You know, what is the point of a non-binding convention? These guys from January until May spent much of their time talking to a universe of the 1,400 or 1,500 people who they thought might be picked for the 1,200 delegate slots. And then that ends in May, and they're talking to the broader public. It is kind of a recipe for a ho-hum race. But one of the biggest things here was there were only five Republican state house primary. So you did not have those local organizations organizing to get out the vote. And that was a big factor. I think that's kind of an easy analysis to give.
Kalila?
Well, I think it's really about process. So the timing of when these things happen, the level of energy or lack of energy in this race. But for many people, it felt like a private backroom deal that then was presented to the public as an option. And I think voters really rebel against that. It's not what we'll see in November. But for a primary election, I think the question now is, where does the responsibility lie? Was it on the part of the parties? Is it the candidates? Or do voters have to take the own initiative to really get excited about these primaries?
On this very point, let's listen to State Republican Party Chairman Jerry Labriola Jr. He was speaking on CTN last night. Here's what he had to say about this.
Maybe Republican voters were comfortable with the work that was done at our state party convention and, and really didn't see a need to rise up and overturn it. And it's one of my theories why we're down a little bit on turnout here in 2014.
So they liked the what happened at the convention so much, there's no need to turn out in a primary, Colin.
You cut out the part where Diane Smith hit him.
I don't think she hit him.
Well, she should have. I mean, that's a ridiculous statement. I mean, Kalilah is very close to the truth, and Jerry Labriola is very far away from the truth. I mean, voters don't have any particular – I mean, they're barely aware of the convention process anyway. To whatever degree they're aware of it at that veiled, dim level that Kalilah just articulated, that it's something that doesn't involve them, and then there's a whole bunch of other results that they can either endorse or not endorse, and that it, I think it does – but, I mean, the idea that it – you know, that inspires confidence is crazy.
Well,
crazy
think,
talk.
But I think that this is really part of what we want.
Hey, for Jerry, that was a good line. Come on.
This is part of what we want to try to get out of a primary, though. Do you think, Kalilah, Republican voters are literally just not that terribly engaged, or that they actually showed up in small numbers but to vote for the candidate that they want, or are they doing what Jerry Labriola said? They're just sort of following the party line wherever the party takes them. I'm trying to figure out what exactly we should draw from the intention of Republican voters in the state from yesterday's results.
Definitely not what the chairman is saying. I don't think that people had confidence in the convention. I think when that happens in May, people have largely forgotten what happened there. So all of the buzz, the rumors, the sort of allegations, that goes to the side. But again, you have this private process where parties can determine who gets to participate in an election. The courts have upheld that. That's fine. But now we're using public dollars, public tax dollars, to finance these private decisions. And so I think for Republican voters, the question is, well, we know that McKinney and Foley aren't Malloy, but we're really not sure what Foley is standing for at this point. And do we want this to be a single issue determined election, or do we want to think about the long game? And I think that has to feed into the hesitancy to see a lot of energy on the part of voters.
And I don't think anybody, Paz, has done a better job in trying to keep from voters what Tom Foley really stands for than Tom Foley himself, who is just time and time again not said anything about what he would do, not taken positions, saying, you know, I don't really need to answer that question to questions about guns and policy and taxes and everything else.
And Mr. Foley is always shocked and hurt when you say that. I think that's part of the problem. That was one of the other factors that fed into the low turnout. Issues that people are passionate about generate turnout. This is not complicated. And, you know, I'll go back to 2006. People were very angry about the war in Iraq. They turned out in large numbers to nominate Ned Lamont, whom nobody had ever heard of a few months before that primary. So issues do matter. They can rev people up. You know, Foley's had a very deliberate primary strategy, which is don't make waves. He believes it's in the bag. And look, to his credit, apparently it was. You know, if the AP numbers hold up, he had a 12-point win. It's a huge win.
It's a 12-point win, but in a very small turnout, Colin, without a whole lot of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. Enthusiasm seemingly that he would need to beat Dan Malloy, who is now an incumbent. I guess one thing we should think about is, was this a good night for Dan Malloy last night? Was the outcome of Tom Foley trouncing a guy who many see might be a better candidate in November, John McKinney, really something that the Malloy campaign should say, yeah, we kind of dodged a bullet there. Now we've got the race we want in November.
Yeah, I mean, this campaign, first of all, it does look like it's sort of like a bar room where a fight is about to break out, and all the drunks think they're going to win the fight. You know, I mean, everybody thinks they're going to win. That's why there's three candidates for lieutenant governor, because, in fact, they think they're going to win. I mean, they think that the ticket's going to win, that they're going to be lieutenant governor. Everybody thinks that they're going to win. I do think, you know, to me, the lasting question of yesterday would be, what would this race have been like if John McKinney campaigned starting in May the way that he campaigned starting in, I don't know, late July or whenever it was that he kind of found his voice? Because, in fact, he was starting to bring up some issues. He was starting to press Foley. He was turning into the kind of candidate who really could make this an interesting race, not only against Foley, but, as you suggest, against Malloy. But unfortunately, and I think there's a lot of reasons for this, but unfortunately, John didn't really get into that mode of energized campaigning, of issue-based campaigning, and of somewhat confrontational campaigning. I mean, it's sort of weird because I think none of us are particularly looking forward to a long string of Foley and Malloy confrontations. It's not going to be Ali versus Frazier. It's not going to be Byrd versus Johnson. It's going to be Godzilla versus Mothra. It's going to be a cheap science fiction monster movie, and I don't particularly want to watch it. So we sort of think, well, we don't like angry confrontational people, but you got to be somewhat confrontational. And John didn't really find his voice that way until way too late. This might have been a much more interesting picture if, coming out of the convention or even preceding the convention, that John McKinney had emerged.
But let's just speak to what the issues really are. I mean, maybe as part of this, guys, that the chief tenet of the Tom Foley campaign for governor is that Dan Malloy has done a bad job and that Connecticut is not a good place to live.
There's nothing wrong with that as an issue. The incumbent is always issue one.
Of course. And I guess the big question is Connecticut the place that Tom Foley thinks it is? Has the economy been so slow to recover? Are businesses so bad off after 4 years of Dan Malloy that it really is time for that change? And maybe that's part of the enthusiasm that we're talking about here that is or is not on the Republican side.
I want your producer to cue up De Niro and the Untouchables doing his talk about enthusiasms. And every time you use the word enthusiasm, I think that should be played. But anyway, let's move on.
Oh, so you just basically begged Fred Karstensen to call.
But I love your thoughts on this. I love your thoughts on this, Kalila, because that really is going to be the key piece that we're going to be hearing for the next couple months. Tom Foley says, this state isn't what it could be, you know, if I was governor, if you'd voted for me last time. And maybe part of what this whole story is that people in Connecticut just aren't that ready to go to the polls and say, yeah, it's so bad we need to make a change.
Well, I think that's a nice teaser, right? That's a nice lead-in. But now people want to know, well, what are you going to do to make it any different or make it any better? You know, think back a year ago where Foley was campaigning in New York City and saying in this ad, well, you didn't get the mayor that you want, so come move to Connecticut in 2 years when I'm governor and things will get better. And beyond the very laughable instance of that's bizarre, the question again becomes why? You have to give voters something more than I'm not that guy. It didn't work for Ned Lamont, right? It worked in the beginning, but then people said, you've brought us in, you can't keep us if you cannot show us what you have to offer beyond saying, I'm not Lieberman.
The incumbent is a great number one issue, and you're absolutely right. You need then the great number two, which is, okay, pal, what are you going to do about it? And, you know, he says he is developing it, but, you know, he promised an urban policy when he announced his exploratory committee in Bridgeport in September. He said that then. And when he was in Waterbury in January to formally get into the race, he again promised an urban policy. Well, folks, it's August and we haven't seen anything. So, you know, we'll see to the extent that Mr. Foley can quickly pivot and show that he has some substantive issues beyond the failings of the Connecticut economy.
He had his party in Waterbury. That's a city, Paz. Colin, last word on this?
I think some of this does depend on whether or not the voters perceive everything that Kalila and Paz are talking about right now. In other words, voters tend to kind of vote a little bit on instinct and on people that they like and that kind of thing. And it's absolutely the job of the press, obviously, to force Tom Foley to really come forth with some real specifics. All right, so you think the business climate is bad. What are you going to do? What kinds of regulations don't you like? You know, is this about environmental regulations? Is this about OSHA? Is it about business taxes? What exact changes would you make? And obviously also this will be the job of the Malloy campaign to point out that so far he's not coming forward with specifics. Malloy has plenty of specifics. He's got 4 years of specifics. I mean, he, like it or not, he can point to exactly what he's done so far. And even looking at the campaign statement, the Malloy campaign statement, they issued their usual sort of thing after last night's Foley victory, congratulating him and looking forward to some really spirited debates. No, I'm just kidding. They said he was a big jerk, that he'd been chirping from the cheap seats and rooting for Connecticut to fail. And that actually might not be too bad a trope for them to invoke, that somehow or other there's this guy who, in that ad that Kalila talked about that ran in New York, he kind of almost wants Connecticut to be a bad place so that he can run against Malloy. I would expect them maybe to blow that particular horn a few more times.
We've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about this race, and we're going to get your thoughts at 860-275-7266. We're also going to talk about a lieutenant governor's race that is right now too close to call and could go to a recount. And who would know more about recounts than anyone else? Denise Merrill, she's Connecticut's Secretary of State. She will join us next in The Wheelhouse, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today it's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We do this on Wednesdays in part because there's often some interesting things to talk about from Tuesdays, like yesterday's primary. We've been talking about Tom Foley beating John McKinney for the nomination once again. He'll take on Dan Malloy in the fall. But there's other races to talk about and other things about our electoral system we'd like to talk to Denise Merrill about. She's Connecticut's Secretary of State, and she joins us in the studio now. Denise Merrill, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much, John.
And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We'd love to get some of your thoughts about how voting went yesterday, where you voted, et cetera. First of all, Denise Merrill, Lieutenant Governor's race is right now. Now, it's too close to call. This sometimes happens. Groton Town Council member Heather Summers, a slight lead right now over Representative Penny Bacciocchi and former U.S. Comptroller General David Walker. They're all within a couple hundred votes of each other. What happens now?
Well, if they are within that 0.5% vote margin of each other, they all qualify. It will be a recount. It's beginning to look like that. We still have until 6 o'clock today for all the different districts to report in. And there are usually a few changes and things along the way. But right now, it looks like all three may be involved in the recount.
And so all three are involved in a recount if all of them are within a certain number of votes of each other. Only two are involved in the recount if that third person is outside that.
That's right. It's basically 0.5% or 1,000 votes, whichever is less. So it looks like at this point, it looks like there were about 80,000 or roughly 20% of the voters voted. And so if that's the case, it looks like right now they're within that margin.
And so we would know the results after a recount when exactly?
Well, we have a week. It has to happen within 7 days. So like I say, tonight, by 6 o'clock tonight, everything will be tallied up, for real. And then we'll see if there is a recount. It is done locally. It's a machine recount. In other words, they're not all counted by hand. They go through them. They send them back through the machines. But it's done in every one of the 169 towns. It's quite a process. We've never had a statewide recount in a primary, or at least in living memory.
But before we move on from this issue, any questions for Denise Merrill about recount in the lieutenant governor's race? I know everyone's very excited about the lieutenant governor's race.
I'm not going to the recount. I just want to say that.
A wise man.
But also think about what the secretary just said. They have until 6 o'clock. They're going to come in on horseback the way they do other years. I mean, Connecticut's system for collecting election data is ridiculous. And I know Secretary Merrill has tried to make some changes, but that requires going out to the provinces and beating up some people.
Oh, we're going to have all sorts of questions about this ridiculous system. I just really want to quickly get a phone call here. We're getting a call from Mark Boughton. He is the mayor of Danbury, and he's joining us. He was tweeting all day yesterday about turnout in his town. I'd like to hear how it happened. Mark Boughton, welcome back to Where We Live.
Hey, thanks, John. It's glad to be here.
So real quick, I know you were letting people know all day long about turnout in Danbury. How did it look by the end of the day?
We finished up, right around 16-17%, a little bit more than what was done, for example, in Greenwich. But it's all relative because there's a lot less Republicans here than there are in a place like Greenwich or other towns. So definitely off from 2010, but then again, I was on the ballot 2010, so you can kind of understand what drove a real high turnout back then. But other than that, very orderly voting and certainly a very exciting race.
Mark, is there any reason that you singled out Tom Foley's hometown for performing more poorly than Danbury?
Well, generally Greenwich has the highest Republican voting population. These kinds of
all right. If you're going to take that, if you're going to take the high road, forget it.
Oh yeah, yes. Paz is just on a fishing expedition here, Mayor.
Well, Paz is the man. Let me just tell you that.
Well, no, I think we all know Paz is the man. So here's the question. We were talking earlier, and we played this tape from Jerry Labriola. He said, people were so enthusiastic about the convention. They just like this candidate. Maybe there's no real need to have a primary. Mark Bowden, you're a Republican who seemingly wants to see Dan Malloy out of office. What do you take away from 20% turnout, from such a lack of enthusiasm, from such a drop the last time around?
By the way, I just pulled up my local news site, and I see the first salvo in the fall campaign against Tom Foley. There's a big banner across my news site here saying Tom Foley does a great job. Anyways, the bombing shall begin immediately. But having said all that, here's a takeaway. One, Republicans have got to do a better job at getting votes to the polls. Our voters have got to get to the polls. We won't win in November if we get the same kind of laissez-faire attitude towards participating in our democracy. So that's going to be critical. And then two, I think I support direct primaries. I think we ought to get rid of the convention process. It's a waste of time for all the candidates. We ought to do these primaries in May. And then the candidates can have all summer to campaign and do all the things that they need to do to be successful.
Denise Merrill, direct primaries. What do you think?
Well, I actually introduced a bill on direct primaries in the 1990s. I don't know if I've changed my mind since then, but it's another way of doing things. The primary system, I don't know if this is just an anomaly. I mean, it is an extremely low turnout. It's very expensive. I think someone earlier said that the real problem here is that these are private party events that the public's paying for.
Well, and that's what Kalilah said. Right, I think that this is an important point, Kalilah.
I think especially for a state like Connecticut, where you have so many independent voters that are outnumbering registered Republicans nearly 2-1. I think that it's not a system that works for Connecticut. It's not effective, and it's not a good use of taxpayer dollars.
Mark, would you open the primary to unaffiliated?
I have mixed emotions about that. I think to build a party is important. To have a party infrastructure is important, and I think you undermine the party. People say, I don't need to join a party because I can vote in primaries, which is one of the – you always see registration tick up around primary time because candidates – And their staff are out there registering people to vote. So I definitely have mixed emotions about it. But I kind of like the idea of the unaffiliated voters, particularly given the high number of unaffiliated voters in Connecticut voting and participating in these things. And frankly, the unaffiliated voter in Danbury and most of the other communities, they make the decisions really at the end of the day about who's the leader.
Colin?
Yeah, Mayor Bowden, as Biggie Small says, we can't change the world unless we change ourselves.
Who says that?
And your icon, your hero, says this. So you talked about sort of the opening salvo and the bombing's about to begin. So this can't be entirely a campaign about negativity. And one of the big issues or questions that's been brought up down the home stretch of this primary is candidate Foley's lack of specificity. Ultimately, I assume that you believe that he has to talk about very specific things. If this is, in fact, a conversation about the business climate in Connecticut, which he seems to want it to be, there do have to be some specifics from him. Do you know what those are? Do you know how he will begin to articulate this? And do you think he even needs to?
Look, I think the press and the insiders love specificity. They love specifics. They want to know where you're going to cut, how you're going to cut it, how you're going to balance the budget. Here's the problem for us that are out, in the field every day. People out there vote on emotion. They vote on feelings. And I think the argument for Tom Foley to win this election will be, frankly, the old Ronald Reagan statement. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? I mean, that's a winning argument for him because people will vote on emotion. I think it's really hard for a candidate to go out there, unless there's two or three just key issues, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, to really go out and be specific. And that's, he has a little more room now. Foley can move to the center, which you'll see him do, I'm sure, because that's, frankly, a center, maybe center-left state. And I think that's where people want to be. But it's hard to do that. It doesn't win elections. I mean, you throw a specific thing you're going to do, 50 people jump on you from 50 different directions about why you can't do that and how it's bad for Connecticut, and you end up losing. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, this is an election that will be based on emotion if Foley's going to win. Now, the governor is very good at detail, and he's very good at specifics, and he's going to argue a lot of these things and try to get specifics, and that's a winning play for him, I think. So it'll be a good battle.
Colin?
Just to wrap that up, Mayor, Biggie said, take a better stand, put money in my mom's hand, get my daughter this college plan so she don't need no man. Maybe that would be a place that Foley could go.
He could do that, or he could get out there and say, just throw your hands up if you're a player, you know, whatever works for you. But
I think that's going to be an independent expenditure ad.
Mark Boughton is the mayor of Danbury, and you can read his tweets all day long. Mayor Mark, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.
This is The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, and we're taking your calls at 860-275-7266. And we're going to – well, here's one of the things I want to talk about. Denise Merrill is here. She's the Secretary of the State. There's so much about the process that we want to talk about. But Mark Boughton was just asked this question about, you know, why people aren't turning out for a Republican primary and whether or not, you know, we should have an open primary. Well, there are these rules that allow you to sign up almost at the last minute to become a Republican, say, if you are currently an unaffiliated voter. With us in studio right now is Tucker Ives, our producer of The Wheelhouse. And Tucker, you and I were in a meeting on Monday, and we were talking about this, and you just sat there at your iPad. You know what? I think I've got this right. I'm going to try on Monday morning to register as a Republican.
And I'll just say I was prompted to do that based on Secretary Merrill's tweet about the noon deadline on Monday. What I did not realize, of course, was at the moment that it was in person. The deadline was in person, not online.
So but right. what was the online deadline?
A week before, the same as the mail-in.
So there's an online deadline and then there's an in-person deadline.
Yes.
So I switched my I was an unaffiliated voter, switched it 35 minutes before that noon deadline for the in-person side of it. And then I got a confirmation email. It was very easy. I actually got the piece of mail yesterday saying I was a card-carrying member of the Republican Party. And when I finally realized later that day that I missed the deadline actually by a week, switched it back to unaffiliated. So if you want to know, I was a Republican for 4 hours, 34 minutes, and 13 seconds based on the very detailed information provided by the online form.
During which time he ordered all these clothes from J. Crew. He's got to return them now.
Oh, I bought three Toby Keith albums.
His memoir will be published in the spring by Knopf.
Tucker Ives, thank you very much for going through that process for us. So this gets to one of the process questions. So there's a deadline that's online, but there's a deadline the week before. It just seemed confusing, Denise Merrill. If we want to get people registered at the very last moment, why can't there just be one deadline that everyone has to meet?
Because we had this debate quite extensively in the General Assembly last year. I'm for as late as possible. By the way, there is also in a general election, you can register to vote on Election Day, Election Day registration now.
But not online.
But not online, no.
No, you have to go someplace and do it
in person. On election day. If you're
on election day, you go in person, yes.
The basic reason that you need that week in between is exactly what Tucker just said. You need to get confirmation by mail still so that you're not actually registered immediately when you go online because we have to cross-check your signature. It then goes by email to the local registrar, and the local registrar then sends you something in the mail, which is why he got it on Tuesday, and that's why you need that week.
So do you think that we are, before we move away from this, do you think that we are going to get closer to a day in which the parties say, you know what, we really do want to be able to have Republicans vote on Democratic primaries, Democrats vote on Republican primaries. Can we move to that direction?
They can do that now. In fact, there was a brief period apparently in the 1980s where Republicans did allow unaffiliated voters to come out in the primary. I suppose the answer is it's a strategic question. As I think someone has already noted, our case went to the U.S. Supreme Court earlier in the decade, and it's been decided over and over again that parties have a right to determine with whom they associate. In other words, they can determine who gets to vote in their primary. I think, again, it goes back to this question of whose primary is it? If the public's paying for it, doesn't that mean it belongs to all of us? Now, on the other hand, do you want to restrict primaries and not have them be public? Because that is, on the other hand, an opportunity for people to vote on someone other than the ultimate candidate. So I'm not sure you want to close it down even more. And, you know, I mean, I'll just make a quick argument for parties here. Parties are not evil. They are people
not
that
mostly evil.
Not mostly evil. They they are packagers of ideas. If we have a complete free-for-all and there are no parties, then you end up with situations where you have almost a cult of personality, I'd say. And we're sort of moving in that direction anyway in terms of presidential elections, for example. And, you know, there are rare instances where people can adhere to some sort of platform. There really is not a party platform that they can force on candidates anymore. And it really has to do with money, but that's another story. But, you know, honestly, if you have no party structure – then you really have a free-for-all, and then the public would have no idea what people think about many issues. So, you know, you have to remember there is a place for party. Maybe people are unhappy right now with the particular platforms of the party. I'm not sure I could even tell you what they are anymore.
I think that's a problem.
Wait, we're right?
Idea that, you know, parties are packagers of ideas, I think the issue now is people don't know what those ideas are, and they don't know from where those ideas come. And to shut out so many people in this state to even have an opportunity to influence those ideas, I think it says a lot about the viability of parties. You know, I teach young people all the time who say, well, why should I register? It doesn't matter. I don't identify with either party. And I say to them, you know, so you can have a voice. That's why it's important. As long as the system is in play, you'll continue to have people who feel like they have no role in the political process. I think that's dangerous. And I think parties need to do a better job of articulating what their views are and trying to include more people in them.
Yeah, you know, I think that parties in Connecticut have sort of fallen apart anyway. I mean, they're really more like a failed state consisting of a whole bunch of warlords running around in Jeeps with machine guns mounted on them. I mean, I don't think there is a central message coming out of Jerry Labriola or Nancy DiNardo or anybody. In terms of the open primary, I think for the Republicans, it's an issue of sort of control versus strategy. I mean, do you want to have control over the process? Who you nominate? You nominate somebody who to whatever extent you can figure out what your ideals are, he conforms to them. Or do you want to basically sort of focus group that candidate with some unaffiliated voters who are going to be the key to the election? In other words, if you nominate a candidate who basically appeals only to your 400,000 member base and not to that $800,000 member group of unaffiliated voters, you're in some ways handicapping yourself somewhat. So strategically, it might be interesting for them to get the unaffiliateds involved. From the point of view of ideology and control, not so great.
No party has a platform anymore. And even when they had them, they were of limited use because once you started the shift to primaries, you can't enforce that. And in fact, both parties have to have a big tent attitude because, you know, you have in both parties, you have you cannot take a position, for example, on, you know, gay marriage or abortion, although the Democrats certainly actually have. But those are the types of things it's hard to bring everybody together. So, yes, you can have some thematic unifying principles that most of your candidates are going to feel comfortable with. But it's always going to come down to really the candidate and what they stand for and who they are.
One of the interesting things about the metaphor, though, Paz, is a big tent is great until you only get about 20% of the people in that tent. Then it looks pretty lousy. Well, then it looks like an empty tent.
But there's two issues here. One is party identification. And then the other one that we're talking about is how do you engage? And when I asked Mayor Boughton about would he be in favor of opening Republican primaries to unaffiliated, I didn't mean that as a rebuke of the party as a structure that should continue, but it is a way to early on for a Republican candidate, or if the Democrats did it, to engage the unaffiliated voters who are the biggest pool of voters in Connecticut. That's a trend that's been very firm, and it's only going to grow, I think.
Denise Merrill, you want to jump in?
Right. I just wanted to go back to this question of the low turnout and reasons for it. And I think there's another factor that's related to all this, which is that the parties are talking – with modern campaigning techniques, parties are talking to a narrower and narrower group of people. And I think that is another reason that not – the larger public is left out of that conversation to a great degree with the what they call micro-targeting and the narrow conversation going on in both parties. You're talking to a very small number of activist people, and that means that's the group that's involved. That's the group that's running things.
And we're actually going to get to one of those issues in a moment here, but I want to take some phone calls. We're in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're talking with Denise Merrill. She's Connecticut's Secretary of the State. She dropped by to talk about some of the results and the turnout from yesterday's primary. Also with us in studio is Kalila Brown-Dean. She's an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, and Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Peter is calling from Stanford. Hi, Peter.
Yes. this conversation is turning into a political party discussion. There are at least, I think, 20 states, if I'm not correct, that do not have party registration. I think like Vermont, I lived in Vermont, and they did not have political party registration. And so I think one-third of the country, if I'm not mistaken, has no party registration. Am I not correct? And I don't know. And I think they do caucuses instead of primaries. I don't know how they actually – on the presidential side, but I don't know exactly how they deal with – if you move to a non-political party state – of registration. I don't know how they deal with the whole issue of political parties.
Well, it's a good question. Denise Merrill, what do you know about your colleagues in other states about party registration?
I'm not sure about party registration. I know Connecticut is on the sort of strong party end of the spectrum generally, and certainly not all states have the primary system. And there have been numerous proposals to do things differently, and some states have things like runoff elections. I know recently Senator Schumer, I think it is, came up with a proposal to eliminate primaries and just go to a runoff system. You know, that has pluses and minuses. All these systems have pros and cons to them, but that's about all I know about whether other states have party registration. I don't know.
Now, of course, as we said, your office is going to be handling a recount likely in the lieutenant governor's race. This is a statewide recount, something we don't usually see. You're also calculating signatures submitted by third-party candidates, Jonathan Pelto and Joe Visconti, to see if they qualify for the ballot in November. Where are you right now in that process?
The deadline has passed for collecting the signatures. That was August 6th. Right now, the local town clerks are counting and verifying all the signatures. They have until August 20th to get that to our office. We then have to recheck. We don't recheck the signatures, but we check the count. And by the end of the month, we will know, you know, whether the signatures are verifiable and they have the 7,500 they need.
Now, we talked to John Pelto recently about the petition deadline. And let's listen to one of the stories he told us about this process.
The process is a state process, but it's carried out by the local towns. And I got a phone call on the way in today that was troubling, and that was that the town clerk in this case, and I believe it was South Windsor, was calling people to ask them whether or not they had signed the petition. For a town clerk to be calling individuals and say, did you sign the petition, as opposed to what their job is the person a voter? And if they are a voter, then to certify that. Now, maybe there was some reason that they did that, but it's an example of even when you're done with the 7,500, this interim process is unto itself yet another step in the getting onto the ballot.
And again, that's John Pelto speaking to us about this process. Very quickly, Denise Merrill, the story that he tells, should a town clerk be calling up individuals and saying, did you sign this petition?
I'm not sure. Their job is to verify the signatures. There's no way to electronically verify them or anything like that. But whether that's beyond the scope of what they're supposed to be doing, I suppose, is arguable. But that's part of the problem is we have 169 towns, 169 town clerks, and they do it within what they believe their authority is. And sometimes the only way you would be able to challenge that would be in court.
Wouldn't it make sense, though, to standardize this as much as possible? I mean, obviously, we don't want to be Florida in 2000, and we don't want to have a situation where in Danielson you get a phone call because there's a motivated town clerk who's a Democrat who wants to knock Pelto out to help Malloy, but in Coventry something else happens and in Ashford something. I mean, it seems to me it ought to be pretty much the same all the way around. Is it within the purview of your office to kind of promulgate standards, say this is how you verify signatures, this is how you don't verify signatures? Please understand the date of birth thing is optional. If they don't put in the date of birth thing, that doesn't mean you can disqualify them. Does it make sense maybe for your central office to say, this is how you do it, this is how you don't do it?
Does it make sense? Of course it makes sense. It's been the fight I've been having for the last 4 years, honestly. And what we can do is give advice. Mm-hmm. And we can interpret the statutes. The statutes are extremely specific. I'm not sure if it gets to that level, but honestly, it probably should be regulation rather than statute that governs some of this. But at this point, our advice does not have the force of law. We actually tried to pass a bill last session, which didn't make it, which said that if we had a legal opinion, it would have the force of law and they would have to obey our opinion. opinion. But at this point, it really is such a decentralized, localized process, and not just with this issue, with all the issues around elections, that it's very difficult to manage and very difficult to get everyone to do exactly the same thing.
People have no idea of exactly how screwed up Connecticut's election system is in many ways, because it is that decentralized. If you have a clerk in Chaplin, and I'm picking Chaplin for a reason, it's the guy who always refuses to send in the voter turnout statistics because the law doesn't require it. So the hell with the Secretary of State. I'm not going to send them in. But, I mean, no, you have that kind of thing. It really gets down to these, you know, local personalities. Some are sticklers for handwriting. Apparently they all went to Catholic school and they learned the cursive method. And you know, some want to see if there's a middle initial on your registration card. It better be on the – you know, there's that kind of stuff that goes on.
But what this has – this gets back to an earlier conversation, though, Kalila, is we were talking about the party system. We were talking about a party of ideas or not about ideas. Why the parties exist at all. Denise Merrill even used the term cult of personality. Maybe that's not what we want running our government. But at the same point, if people rally behind someone with ideas – no matter how many people rally behind those ideas, maybe if they can get on the ballot, they may draw some support. John Pelto, Joe Visconti, very different people. They're trying to petition on the ballot. And it seems as though every single thing that Connecticut does makes it more difficult for them to do that than should be reasonable.
And that is why we have the party system that we do in Connecticut. The rules of the game matter. And the rules of the game make it nearly, not impossible, but make it very difficult for a third-party candidate to wage a substantive campaign. When it is so hard to get onto the ballot, when people say, well, if I affiliate with a party, all I have to do is really stand up and say, I have an idea. I don't have to tell you that idea, but I have an idea. I'm going to run under this banner. That should not determine the quality of the democracy that we have access to. And so it's a bigger issue, not just for Connecticut, but a national conversation. If we say that we believe in ideas, we believe that people should be able to express those ideas, not be bound by that, why does the process make it so difficult? It's why you can have third parties flourish in Rhode Island, but really struggle here in Connecticut.
Hey, and I'll just give you the last word before we end this conversation, Denise Merrill. But, you know, John Pelto even said, it should be hard for me to get on the ballot. It shouldn't be easy. But at the end of the day, it seems impossibly hard for him, for Joe Visconti, for anybody in the future.
Actually, here's now where I'm going to go the other way on this, because compared with many other states, it's relatively easy to get on the ballot in Connecticut. 7,500 signatures is not a high bar, as I think even John would tell you.
But are there other states where you have 169 different destinations where those signatures have to go to? If you're standing in front of Big Y, you've got to have eight different petitions, one for Bark Hampstead, one for Avon, one for Simsbury. See, that's an area where I think a lot of states don't have our system.
That's correct, although there are some. And there are some, like Vermont still has the system. I mean, our problem is we don't have counties. So many other states operate their elections on the county system, which I have also proposed. But anyway, that aside, Connecticut third parties have been successful, and I think you have only to mostly, let's face it, people like Weicker or Lieberman who had already a party affiliation, rejected it, and did something else. But, you know, so I wouldn't want to say that 7,500 signatures, you need a bar, as you said. I mean, you can't just have a ballot that's 60 pages long with people with different ideas. On the other hand, I think we could do a lot better in the sort of procedural area where we would centralize it more, probably in our office, and have the signature process be a lot less onerous. I mean, it's ridiculous if you're standing in front of Stop and Shop and you get people from six different towns there, which you're liable to do. It's ridiculous that you can't check it. We have a statewide voter file now. There's no reason we can't do that.
And that's really the point. When we brought on Tucker earlier, the fact that he can go on a website and register, even maybe not at the last moment, but register to vote through a statewide portal. But yet somehow or other, that's not good enough to actually get a signature. That's kind of crazy. That's the part that I don't understand.
Well, yeah. And by the way, the online system is brand new. We only got that up in February, and that's through the efforts of my office.
Denise Merrill is Connecticut's Secretary of the State. Thank you so much for stopping by with us. Good luck with that recount. We'll be in touch with you. I know that
I sounds wait.
You seem very excited about that. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Jeff Cohen's going to join us. We're going to talk about one of the interesting state races for state legislature that happened yesterday in Hartford, also maybe some in Bridgeport that Pazniokas can tell us about. There's a lot to talk about still in the last 10 minutes of Where We Live.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, with summer fading, fall fast approaching, it's time for states to get ready for the second round of open enrollment under the Affordable Care Act. We'll look back at some experiences from the first enrollment period. We'll get a little checkup on Obamacare on tomorrow's show. Today in the Wheelhouse, we're talking about the results of the primary yesterday with Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Mark Pazniokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, Kalila Brown-Dean, who's an Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, and quickly joining us now is Jeff Cohen. He's WNPR's Capital Region reporter, and you were covering a very interesting race in Hartford that was really close last night, Jeff.
Yeah, I was. It was an interesting race in Hartford that was between State Senator Eric Coleman and Hartford City Council President Sean Wooden. It's important to note in these kinds of races, especially in a place like Hartford, Windsor, and Bloomfield. Hartford, you know, for all intents and purposes, this is the general election, right? In towns that are so Democratic. So that's one thing to note. The second thing is that this, depending on who you ask, this was a referendum of sorts on the idea of building a new minor league baseball stadium in Hartford for the New Britain Rock Camp. But it also, you know, this is a fairly standard story of how it's hard to beat an incumbent, even if that incumbent, it's hard to beat an incumbent. Let's leave it at that. Eric Coleman has been in his seat for nearly two decades. And if you look outside of Hartford, where his opponent is from, Sean Wooden, the city council president, Eric Coleman really won the town of Bloomfield, according to the unofficial numbers I saw last night. So, you know, this was a small effort, a few thousand people, but it keeps in a fairly senior and, I guess, powerful incumbent exactly where he is.
And we just have a few minutes left. Paz, I wanted you to just take us through some of the other interesting legislative races. Some of them happened in Bridgeport, the other town that we were following yesterday.
Yeah, most of them happened in Bridgeport, I think. The most interesting one is Marilyn Moore defeating Senator Tony Musto in the Democratic primary down in Bridgeport, Trumbull, and a piece of Monroe, I believe. And she was backed by the working families. There was a small independent expenditure. She's backed by CCAG. She is a big backer of the so-called Walmart bill that would get some of these big corporations to pony up if a lot of their employees rely on state benefits to keep their employees whole. So that one actually was a campaign about ideas and about issues. Also in Bridgeport, you know, we have a big sigh of relief from a lot of Democrats that Ernie Newton, he, after being released from prison, he tried to make a comeback for his old state Senate seat. He lost that 2 years ago. He tried to make a comeback this year for his old House seat. I don't know where he goes next, but Democrats are so relieved because there's a pending investigation with him and nobody wanted that circus.
Colin?
Sort of an interesting year that way. The Hartford and Bridgeport results are kind of the opposites of each other in the sense that Coleman really probably did win with a pretty heavy suburban vote in Bloomfield. Musto needed a bigger vote in Trumbull, which is more his base. And I think Bridgeport, at least the early numbers kind of look like Bridgeport came out for his opponent. He didn't get the kind of help that he needed from his own base. In each case, so these are senators who, you know, they haven't done anything terrible or wrong. They're not involved in scandals or anything like that. So it's kind of interesting, you know, that they have such significant challenges.
But also on a day that we talk about turnout, Kalila, these are also results that happen in very, very, very small numbers in cities like Bridgeport and Hartford.
But I think what we'll see in the general election is that those cities will really matter to the overall winners, not just with the governor's race, but when we look at, you can't really win in Connecticut if you can't capture the cities. And so you mentioned earlier about Foley now saying he wants to have this urban initiative. It's going to be interesting. I think that Bridgeport race will be key, so that winning the general election for Moore is going to be very difficult, but we'll speak to this idea again. Do people like ideas? Do they like energy? Do they like character and personality? Or will it be strictly a party vote?
Marilyn Moore's win may help Dan Malloy because you have activists who know how to run campaigns who are going to be really trying to pull the vote out for her, and that will benefit Malloy as well.
What we were all hoping for is it would all come back to Bridgeport once again.
It always does.
For the general election in November. Thanks to Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and our own Jeff Cohen from WNPR as well. Thanks to producer Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us on Where We Live.